science, which it has been pointed out is really to be the Oxford professor of being Richard Dawkins. It will be very difficult to find a successor. Richard Dawkins' first book, of course, was The Selfish Gene in 1976. And it was a book that accomplished something truly remarkable. It didn't just explain evolution to the masses, it explained evolution to the evolutionists. Members of a whole profession blinked and said, ah, that's what we're about. And it was the metaphors and the models that this book elaborated that crystallized, again, for a whole profession, what had been for many a sort of hovering idea. It's a book that gave contours to a cloud. And not just that. John Maynard Smith, the late great dean of theoretical biology, often observed that a whole cohort of budding scientists became biologists because of Richard Dawkins, because of the selfish gene, because of the blind watchmaker, because of Climbing Mount Improbable, because of its many successors, which is an extraordinary achievement. And it's almost a scholastic quibble to ask whether it is, in the first instance, a writerly achievement or a scientific achievement. Because I think what we can say is that in the post-war era, across the board, very few people have done more to advance human understanding than Richard Dawkins. At the beginning of The Selfish Gene, Richard Dawkins famously wrote that intelligent life on a planet comes of age when it first works out the reasons for its own existence. If that's so, Richard Dawkins has helped intelligent life come of age. So please welcome.
May I have a transcript of that introduction?
I want to begin with a little quote, actually, from River from Eden, out of Eden. The universe has precisely the qualities we should expect if there is no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. That's pretty bleak. So many people turn to religion, it seems, because of a craving for a sense of purpose, a sense of an answer, not just how things came from, but in some sense, what they're for. Some people might worry that a vacuum is left by this kind of, you know, radically materialistic account of our existence. And I'm curious what you would say to those people.
One can be cosmically bleak without being personally bleak. There's a great confusion between those two. We have to make our own purposes, and we all of us do. We are equipped by natural selection with brains that are very good at setting up purposes. Originally, I suppose they would have been purposes like stalking a wildebeest or finding a water hole or finding fire. And our brains are machines for setting up purposes and then setting up designs and plans and schemes for achieving them. And we still have those, although the designs and plans and schemes are nowadays, of course, very different. We are so imbued in our brains with this purpose-seeking mechanism that we think it must apply to the universe and to the sun and to the stars and to the weather. And so when we are told that the universe has no purpose, the universe and the stars and the sun and the clouds have no purpose, we are apt to reflect that back on ourselves and think that therefore life has no purpose. But we can still set up our own purposes. They'll be very different from hunting a wildebeest. There'll be things like finishing a book or persuading somebody we love to love us back. There are all sorts of local purposes which can be very high. They don't lack spirituality. They don't have to be materialistic in the denigrating sense of the word. They are, of course, materialistic. I am materialistic in the philosophical sense, but in the sense of appreciating music and poetry and things like that, we don't have to be materialistic in the